The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
For years, a group of Missouri lawmakers have been trying to find a way to pass a tax credit incentive for K-12 scholarships, which they believe could provide a better opportunity for kids that live in areas with underperforming schools. State Representative Phil Cristofanelli was the sponsor of a measure that finally broke the decades-long logjam. And the St. Charles County Republican joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to explain what empowerment scholarship accounts are and respond to critics who think they're a bad idea. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio, he is the representative for Missouri's 105th House District and a recent graduate of Washington University Law School. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Phil Cristofanelli is here. By the way, did you know that you are now part, assuming that you passed the bar, because I don't think you've taken the bar exam yet.
End of July.
You are part of an illustrious group of Missouri House members that got their law degree while serving in the House. That includes former State Representative Stephen Weber, former State Representative Chris Kelly, former Representative and Senator Ken Jacob, and most notably, former Governor Warren Hearns.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. And Steve Carroll.
And Steve Carroll as well. Yes. How exactly did you do that without going crazy?
Well, that seems to be a loaded question. I don't know that I did, but it certainly took a lot of planning. You had to plan everything out in advance. You had to pretty much give up your entire social life for 3 years and really had to knuckle down and juggle a lot of chainsaws. But it all worked out in the end, and I'm glad I did it.
Well, congratulations on that accomplishment. But we're not here to talk about your multitasking.
Sure.
We're here to talk about a couple of bills that you sponsored that made it through the legislative process, as well as the ongoing and upcoming special sessions. So the thing that I wanted to talk with you about first is empowerment scholarship accounts, which are known as ESAs. We're going to refer them to as ESAs throughout the rest of the program. This is an idea that has been proposed by primarily Republicans, but it's been supported by some Democrats for decades. In fact, I think when he was a senator, Peter Kinder had a similar idea to this. Explain what the idea actually is and what it's trying to accomplish.
Sure. ESA stands for Empowerment Scholarship Accounts. And so what those are they are grants to students who qualify under certain criteria that is laid out in the bill. And it allows those students to use that grant for a number of approved educational expenses. The most common expense for an Empowerment Scholarship account is private school tuition, but it could also be used for extra tutoring. It could be used for extracurricular activities, summer programs, transportation, school supplies, whatever it takes to get that kid the education that will allow them to realize their full potential. As you mentioned, that this is an idea that has been around for some time. It exists in one form or another in over 26 states. I think there's close to three or four other states that passed a similar program this year, and it has been introduced in the state of Missouri for well over 15 years, but this was finally the year that we made it happen.
So I want to walk through how this would actually work. Let's just say that I am a multi-billionaire, and I wanted to donate $10 million to a approved educational assistance organization. So how would that benefit me under this plan? I'm just using the $10 million mark as kind of a round number to understand like what how much my tax liability would be reduced.
Sure. And let's be clear, it's not really a benefit to the donor other than, you know, they feel good about the fact that they helped out an education assistance organization. The donor ends up net neutral. So what they do is if you want to donate, I think you said $10 million, you first would have to have a state tax liability on your state income tax of $20 million, which almost no one does.
But
we'll just take this hypothetical. If you donated that $10 million to an EAO, you would be granted a tax credit of up to $10 million, which is 50% of your overall tax liability to the state. And so when you pay your Missouri income taxes the next year, you would pay, you have a $20 million obligation, you'd pay your 10 and then you'd use your credit for the other 10. So you're still out $20 million, but you essentially were able to dedicate 10 of that $20 million to an EAO for the purpose of helping kids.
What is the cap for the state? Because I know that that was a source of contention as this was going through the process.
Sure. Yeah, and it changed throughout the process, and we could get into the details of how there were two bills ultimately that created the ESA program. But assuming both House Bill 349 and Senate Bill 86 are signed, the cap will be, in the first year, $25 million in tax credits that could be issued. And that is allowed to grow at the rate of inflation up to $50 million for a total cap of $50 million at the fullness of the program.
When would you get to that $50 million cap? I think that could be years before we get
sure.
there.
Yeah, I was actually looking at the fiscal note. They just sent me one this morning, and it's like 2050 before we ever hit the full cap.
Which hopefully we're both still alive by then, but you know.
Yeah, I'm planning to be.
I'm planning to be too. So I know that the biggest argument against this idea, and it's been there's been bipartisan support for this idea, but also bipartisan opposition, is the opponents feel like this is a backdoor way of siphoning away money from public schools, which I think you heard over and over again during debate. So I want you to address that argument.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's false. Because the $25 million is going to come out of general revenue, and education is just a portion of our budget. That $25 million was in no way earmarked for education. Education in our current budget is going to be fully funded. It's going to get more money than it did the year previous. So there's no evidence to suggest that $25 million was going there and then now is not. But also, we put in a number of sweeteners in the bill for the public school community. The most notable one was the transportation trigger. The state historically has underfunded its obligation to transportation in mostly rural school districts, but also some urban ones. We said that in order for the scholarships to take effect every year, we need to hit at least 40% of our transportation target. And in the governor's last budget, I think we started out at 32. And as a result of this legislation, we've brought that up to 40 for a total investment of $18 million more in school transportation than the year previous. Another thing we did is we held public schools harmless for 5 years from the start of the program. So if you have a kid in your public school that leaves under an education scholarship for a private school, we're going to still let the public schools count that kid in their average daily attendance numbers. And that would make sure that they will not lose any money as a result of that kid's absence, even though they no longer have the obligation to educate that student.
Another aspect of this bill that I think was a source of controversy was about where it would actually take effect and how more rural areas it wouldn't apply. Can you kind of walk us through that part of the bill?
Sure. So in order to be a qualified student that can receive a scholarship, You have to be a resident of a first-class charter county or a city with a population of greater than 30,000, which is most of the students in this state, but does leave out some very small rural parts of the state as far as population goes. I want to say like 70% of the state is covered under the ESA bill. And there are a number of reasons for that. A lot of the rural school districts have very small schools that if they lose, even 5 to 10 students, it could be very difficult for those schools to remain in operation. And that's just not the case in your more urban environments. And also in rural Missouri, a lot of times, other than the local public school, there just simply isn't anywhere else to go. A lot of times there's no reliable broadband, so you can't really do online learning, and there's not a lot of private schools out there because there's not enough population density. And so the goal of the start of this program is to target the scholarships where they could be the most useful, and that is our highly populated urban centers. Like all these programs across the state, they start small and narrowly defined, and after people see the success of the program, they almost always become politically popular and expand. That's what we've seen in every state where they've been introduced. So I would look at this as just a start. It's certainly not one that everybody was happy about, but it was one that we could finally get to a compromise agreement on.
Indeed, there were opponents of this bill that were very unhappy that some of the rural areas were carved out. I think that they accused people like you of doing this so it would get votes of rural legislators that don't like this idea. State Representative Rachel Prouty, who represents North St. Louis County, said, quote, "If you think this bill does not help your community, just imagine what it may do to mine." Can you address that criticism that this was done as a political reason to get the bill passed and not for the reasons that you just mentioned?
Sure. And I mean, there is certainly compromises that happen throughout the legislative process, and it's not uncommon for bills to be targeted to particular areas. I would say that as a guy from St. Charles, I want as much of this $25 million going to my district as possible. And quite frankly, if they put all $25 million in St. Charles, I'd be happy with that. But, you know, we compromised and we broadened it to a greater part of the state. And it is my belief, like I mentioned before, that ultimately this will be a statewide program because it is going to be very successful. And in the meantime, I think that anybody who gets one of these scholarships is going to be happy with it, and they're going to want to see the program expand.
Let's talk about other legislation that you successfully pushed across the finish line. This, I think this is actually multiple bills dealing with HIV, both the medication and the laws surrounding it. Can you kind of talk about why you decided to sponsor or support some of these ideas, and what do you think it will do in this area of policy?
Sure. Missouri has been cited as a growing area of concern on a national level for our rising HIV rates. We are ranked 7th in the country with increased infections. It's unfortunate because there are so many advancements in science that have occurred that can help reduce the spread of this disease. We don't currently have a cure to HIV, but we do have a way to ensure that people do not become infected. And I believe if we implement those strategies over time, we can end HIV in our lifetime. I was happy to sponsor two pieces of legislation, which ultimately became law this year. The first one allows what's known as post-exposure prophylaxis to be distributed over the counter by a pharmacist without a prescription. And what post-exposure prophylaxis is if you have been exposed or believe you have been exposed to the HIV virus, if you take this drug within 72 hours, you can almost guarantee that you will not become infected with HIV. So it's really a miraculous drug. But people can't always see their physician within 72 hours. And so we expanded the scope of practice of pharmacists to be able to dispense this life-saving medication. And Missouri became the third state in the nation after California and Colorado to take this course. So I'm really proud of that particular bill. And then we had another piece of legislation which modernized our HIV criminal code. Our criminal code was based off of really a number of bad assumptions that were made. It was made based off of the best science of the time, but this was in the 70s and 80s when a lot of these bills were written. And there were two underlying premises that were wrong that these laws were based on. The first was that HIV was a death sentence. And at the time, if you did contract HIV, your life expectancy was relatively low. But that has changed dramatically. Now, under our modern medical regime, you can live a long and healthy life while being HIV positive, because we have medications that can reduce your viral load essentially down to an undetectable level. And so with that assumption built into our criminal code, there were a lot of laws baked into the books where if you were HIV positive and engaged in certain activities, be it violence or even knowing transmission of the virus to another person, you were charged with essentially an A felony, which is the same that we give for premeditated murder, which is out of step with what virtually every other state in the country has done. And so we modified those to make them more in line with what the modern penal code would recommend for those type of crimes. The other thing we did is we got rid of all the crimes that related to activities that actually could not transmit the virus. So, for instance, if you were HIV positive and you spit on another person, you could be criminally charged with very severe penalties. But now we know that saliva does not transmit HIV, and so there's really no purpose to criminalize that type of activity any more than you would a basic assault or battery based off of spitting. And so we changed all that to accord with all what we know now about the virus. And I think it'll make a big difference in alleviating the stigma around getting tested and knowing your status.
A couple of questions. Let's start with the first bill. Let's just say that I find out within 24 hours that I may have been exposed to HIV. How would I just be able to go into a Walgreens, go up to a pharmacy counter and say, can I get this drug? Like, is it as simple as that? Or is it more complicated than that?
It's about as simple as that. The pharmacist is going to ask you some questions, some screening questions to make sure that, one, that you engaged in an activity that actually had a potential for transmission. Because like I mentioned, not every exposure to someone who is HIV positive is an exposure that could potentially transmit the virus. So there's going to be some screening there. There's also going to be some screening for contraindicated medications and underlying conditions where you might not want to take this particular medication. And the way it's structured is the physician or the pharmacist is going to be operating under a protocol that is approved by a licensed physician. And so it's very similar to how people are getting vaccines from their pharmacists currently. And so it will be as easy as you're going to walk into the Walgreens. You're probably going to be privately screened to make sure that there's no problems. But after that, you'll be able to access the medication right away.
For the second bill, you mentioned that before your bill passed, it was an A felony if you knowingly transmitted HIV to someone. Did it go down to like a misdemeanor? Is it a lower felony? Like, what would be the punishment if you did that and you were found guilty of that?
It's a C felony now. That's still a very serious crime that accompanies with it, I want to say, a range of 10 or more years in prison. And let's be clear that knowingly or purposely transmitting a virus is a very serious offense, and it should be treated seriously. But the issue was that our criminal code, as it compared to other criminal codes across the state, was based on false assumptions, and it was out of line with the standard punishment that was given for those crimes around the country.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative Phil Crisafinelli.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Republican State Representative Phil Crisafinelli. He represents a portion of St. Charles County in the Missouri House. So we're recording this on Thursday morning. There is currently a special session going on right now involving the renewal of a critical tax known as the Federal Reimbursement Allowance, or FRA. We're going to be talking about this issue fairly generally, because by the time this podcast is released, there may be massive or not massive movement in the Missouri Senate about what exactly will be in it. I'll just ask you, though, generally, what's kind of your feeling about having to go back into special session to renew this very, very critical tax that, if it's not renewed, could blow a billion-plus hole in the budget, basically?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'm disappointed that we weren't able to get it done during the general session. I had a number of pieces of legislation that the FRA was placed on, and we tried to move those at the end of session, but it just kept getting tied up for various other people's plans for that particular program. And so we got down to the finish line. We weren't able to get it done. And that's unfortunate. But, you know, we all signed up to be in the legislature, so can't complain too much if we have to go back to work and finish something that we didn't get done in the first 5 months. So I stand ready and willing to take on this challenge in the next couple weeks, and I'm confident that we're going to get the FRA passed.
Do you need to get that phone call?
You know, it's Cody. We could dial him in to the the podcast here as a surprise. He probably wouldn't appreciate that.
Yeah, that. Yeah. By the way, that is House Budget Chairman Cody Smith, who has been on the podcast recently, and I think that he was one of the people trying to get this FRA thing done. The reason why the FRA was not done is there were senators, specifically senators, that wanted restrictions on Medicaid from going towards certain types of contraception, or Medicaid from going to Planned Parenthood for non-abortion related services. And this is Senate Minority Leader John Rizzo. He's a Democrat from Independence, kind of providing some commentary on where we are now in politics in Missouri.
This is about birth control because they have cut to the bone on all of their pro-life legislation for so long that there's literally nowhere left for them to go to get their pro-life street credibility in their political atmosphere. And they're all running in primaries now because Roy Blunt decided to retire in the middle of session, which, you know, good for him. I wish him well in his retirement. He served the state well for a long time. And all these congressional seats are opening up. Everyone's jockeying for a position in the Republican primaries in those congressional seats, if not for the U.S. Senate seat. And you have very powerful people that are doing that.
What do you make of Senator Rizzo's comments?
Well, you know, I think that it's pro-life issues are something that is always going to come up in Missouri politics, because I've found that they're one of the top issues that get mentioned by constituents. When I go door to door, I hear about on both sides of the abortion debate a lot of interest in that issue, and politicians tend to respond to those pressures. And I'm not surprised that pro-life issues have found their way into the FRA. I think that this is something that the Missouri legislature can work through, and they can work through in a way that will be reasonable and come to a conclusion that maybe not everyone's happy with, but is still within the mainstream of what we're seeing around the rest of the country.
Now, again, I just want to be very clear here. I don't know what the final outcome is going to be, and it may be decided when this show goes up. But I think that there are even some Republicans. I saw a tweet from State Representative Shamed Dogan saying that conflating contraception with abortion is fundamentally dishonest. And, you know, there were efforts before by Republicans to expand birth control to people. What do you kind of make of that argument? Because I assume that Democrats are primarily going to be making that argument, but I wouldn't be surprised even if some Republican legislators are not super comfortable with the way this special session is going.
Well, you know, I think it's based on a lot of assumptions. This bill is still in a very formative stage, and I think that there was a version earlier in the general session that was written very broadly and did capture a number of contraceptive drugs and devices. But I don't necessarily know that that was the members' intent when they drafted that legislation. And I've not spoken with them on the matter, so I don't know what their intent is. I don't believe that ultimately we're going to have an FRA that restricts contraception in any way. There may be, abortive fashion drugs that are not going to be covered under the FRA, and, you know, that is a very a common restriction that exists in a number of other states. There may be a ban on certain populations accessing Planned Parenthood facilities, but that is also a very common restriction that exists in other states. I don't expect that there will be any restrictions placed on contraception in the FRA.
And just to be clear, when we talk about restrictions on contraception, we're not talking about banning these for the general population. We're talking about whether Medicaid reimburses for them.
Yes,
I think
absolutely.
That needs to be emphasized. But let's move on to a special session that will happen probably in the fall, maybe the winter. I asked Governor Parson when. He said, I don't know. And we're talking about congressional redistricting. I think that there are two routes that congressional redistricting can take. One is the legislature creates a map that's reasonably similar to what we have now, where you have six safe Republican districts and two safe Democratic districts. There's also kind of talk about a 7-to-1 map that kind of chops up the 5th district in Kansas City. And, you know, there are people who feel like that is going to happen. And there are even some Republicans who are like, that could put other districts at risk. We're just going to keep Cleaver's district the same. With that as a backdrop, what are kind of your expectations for what happens when you all come back from congressional redistricting?
You know, it'll be interesting. I think that a lot of the changes are probably going to be made over the Senate side just because the structure of the body is more conducive to collaboration and compromise on an issue of this type. In the House, there's going to be the House Redistricting Committee. They are going to provide a map, and it'll go to the House floor and get an up or down vote. It probably won't be changed very much on the floor. But in the Senate, you know, every senator has filibuster power, and they're going to have to deal with all of them. And there's probably going to be a lot of changes and compromises and deals made over on the Senate side as it relates to redistricting.
Obviously, this is an audio podcast, and you can't really see me showing this phone to the representative. But Dave Wasserman, who's a very famous political analyst, he was circulating this map that was called like the status quo map, which would keep the 5th district basically the same.
I did see that, yes.
This doesn't have county lines on it, but this would be a map that would have pretty much all of St. Charles in the 2nd district.
That's right.
Which I'm sure you would probably support as a St. Charles County Republican, but a lot of people, including a lot of St. Louis County Republicans, are not going to be super enthusiastic about this. How realistic do you think it would be to have a St. Charles County-based House district?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people that would like to see that happen. It's been far too long for St. Charles to go without a clear representation in Congress. We've been split and diced and sliced for decade after decade after decade. And we are one of the fastest growing areas in the state right now. We are where a lot of our economic activity is occurring. We are attracting people from not only other parts of Missouri, but other parts of the country to come and live in our state. And you know, given our population numbers, it certainly makes sense that we'd be included all in one congressional district and be able to elect someone of our choosing to Congress. But all these things are part of a political process, and you know, people are going to be making all sorts of agreements based off of their own political interests or their area's political desires. And it's really hard to say how it's going to all turn out in the end.
Do you think that Senator Onders' involvement in plunging the General Assembly into a special session, because he's been the sponsor of the amendment to bar Medicaid from reimbursing Planned Parenthood, do you think that some Republicans are super, super mad at him and may retaliate by making sure that a St. Charles County congressional district never even gets considered?
You know, they're always mad at each other over in the Senate. Like, this is nothing new. It's I think that, you know, they get mad and then they realize that, oh, hey, we still have to work together. We still have a whole nother year of session where, you know, any one senator can gum up the works. And so I think memories tend to be short in the legislature. And while you may be enemies on one day and one particular issue, when it comes to the next issue, a lot of times you can put that aside and get to work on what's best for your constituents in the state. And so I'm confident that the Senate has the power and ability to do that regardless of any sort of political controversy that may be it may exist at any given point in time in the past.
So this is kind of an unprecedented situation. I don't remember the last time that redistricting happened for congressional redistricting, and Republicans held the governorship and both houses of the legislature with supermajorities. I think, I mean, I'm sure it's happened maybe in the 1800s or something, but not in recent memory. So I've been pretty blunt about this. I don't think the Democrats are going to play any role in this. I mean, they may, but they have no leverage to do anything. But there are going to be people like State Representative Tracy McCreary who are going to try to use the bully pulpit to influence the process. This is what she had to say on a recent episode of Politically Speaking.
It's no secret that Democrats are in the super minority in both the House and the Senate. But I truly believe that Missourians who are represented by Republicans are going to be communicating with their elected officials between now and when we have our special session on redistricting about the importance of making sure the maps are drawn fairly. So this should be a nonpartisan issue. When you're out in town, it's a nonpartisan issue, but communities want to be able to have choices when they go to vote. They don't want the primary to be the only place where they vote for people.
You're probably going to hear that argument a lot from your Democratic colleagues. What will be your response when you hear that?
You know, I think that they are underestimating their influence over the process. As I mentioned, there are a number of Democrat members of the Missouri Senate. They have unlimited filibuster power, and they have a lot of votes that they can offer to various factions within the Republican Party that want one map over another, and they're going to be a part of the process, and they're going to be able to be heard and have an impact on what our final maps are going to look like. They don't have the governor's office anymore, that's true, but I don't think that they are completely irrelevant, as has been suggested.
Yeah, and in fact, I'll piggyback on that point a little bit. If you go back in the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's actually been a pretty strong alliance between Republicans and Black Democrats to make sure the first district has either a majority or plurality African-American population, because that ensures that there's a Black congressperson out of St. Louis, but it also ensures that the second district is fairly Republican. So it kind of meets both of those interests. And also, like, if there are Republicans that want to keep the 5th district Democratic to prevent the 6th or the 4th district from becoming more Democratic, that's another example of Democrats working together. Now, I'm sure that there are a lot of Democrats who are like, that's not the type of working together I want if I want competitive districts. But Is that kind of what you were referring to earlier, or am I not reading between the lines correctly?
I think that's certainly a possibility of how it could play out. The Republican Party is certainly not a monolith, and neither is the Democratic Party in the state of Missouri. There are different interests and different factions, and sometimes those interests and factions overlap and align across party lines in the Capitol. And you're going to see a lot of that play out over the course of redistricting.
My final question for you, same as my final question for Representative McCreary, do you expect any other special sessions besides FRA and congressional redistricting?
There's been a lot of calls for special session. After seeing them all, I placed a call of my own for any bill that I wasn't able to pass in the general session. Still waiting to hear back from the governor's office as to whether we're going to do that one or not. But my guess is that the two you listed are probably the only we do this year.
Well, as much as I would have loved to cover 13 special sessions, we'll have to wait till 2022 to deal with some of the unfinished business. Representative, thank you so much for coming to St. Louis to record an episode of this show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can read all of our stories at stlpr.org and follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
At PHL Christo on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook too. Just Google my name.
Thank you very much, and until next time, so long.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.